This time she knew it was different. She felt him slipping away from her, as if he already had one foot out the door, as if he were coming up with an exit plan. She'd never thought before that he would actually leave her. She didn't think he had the guts. Because he knew that if he left her, he wouldn't get a cent. That was the beauty of the prenup. If he left her, he wouldn't get half her fortune. He wouldn't get anything. And he needed her money, because he didn't have much left of his own. Like Marco's, Richard's business had not been doing well in recent years. He kept the unprofitable business going so people wouldn't know that he'd failed, so he could pretend to be the big businessman. She'd been pouring her own money into the company just to help him save face. She hadn't minded at first, because she loved him. She doesn't love him anymore. Not after this. She's known for months that this affair was more serious than the others. In the beginning, she'd turned a blind eye, waiting for it to end, as the others had. After all, the physical part of their marriage had been over long ago. But as the affair continued, she became obsessed with finding out who this other woman was. Richard was good at hiding his tracks. She couldn't trip him up. Finally, she'd overcome her distaste and hired a private detective. She'd hired the most expensive one she could find, assuming, rightly, that he would be the most discreet. They met on a Friday afternoon to go over his report. She thought she'd been prepared, but what the detective had found shocked her. The woman her husband was seeing was that woman living next door to her daughter, Cynthia Stillwell. A woman almost half his age, a friend of his daughter's, a woman he'd met at a party at his daughter's house. It was disgraceful. Alice sat in Starbucks, staring at her veined hands clutching her purse, as the high-priced private detective with the Rolex reviewed his findings. She looked at the photos and quickly looked away. He went over the timelines, places, and dates. She paid him in cash. She felt ill. Then she went home and decided to bide her time. She would wait for Richard to tell her he was leaving her. She didn't know what he was going to do for money, and she didn't care. She only knew that if he asked her for any, she would say no. She'd asked the private detective to keep an eye on her bank accounts, to see if Richard was siphoning money off her. She'd decided to keep the detective on retainer. But they wouldn't meet at the same Starbucks again. She'd find some place more private. The whole experience had left her feeling dirty. Then Cora had been taken that very night, the same day she'd met with the private investigator, and Richard's sordid affair had been thrust aside by the horror of the kidnapping. Alice had feared at first that perhaps her daughter had harmed her baby, and that she and Marco might have hidden the body to keep from being discovered. Anne had that illness, after all, and she was struggling with motherhood. She was under a lot of stress, and Alice knew that stress was a trigger for someone like Anne. Then, it had been such a relief. The onesie and the note from the kidnappers had arrived. What a roller coaster it's been, believing they would get Cora back that day, then losing her again. Through it all, the grief and fear for her baby granddaughter and the concern about her daughter's fragile emotional state. And then, tonight. It wasn't until tonight that she figured it all out. She'd been shocked to hear Marco admit that he'd taken Cora himself, more shocked still to hear Marco accuse her husband of setting him up. But then, as she sat there with her arms around her shattered daughter, it all started to make an awful sense. Richard's grand plan. The kidnapping. Setting Marco up to take the fall. Where was the 5 million? She was pretty sure Richard had it hidden somewhere. And then there's the second 2 million, which has been sitting ready in the back of the closet in the front hall, in another gym bag, waiting for the next attempt. She'd never seen the note or the cell phone. Richard told her he'd destroyed them. Richard was going to relieve her of $7 million under the guise of getting her only grandchild back from kidnappers. The son of a bitch. So he could leave her for that appalling Cynthia. Bad enough that he was unfaithful, that he was leaving her for a woman as young as her daughter. Bad enough that he was trying to take her money. But how dare he hurt her daughter this way? And where is her granddaughter? She reaches for her own cell phone and calls Detective Razback. She has things to tell him now. She would also like to see a photograph of this man, Derek Honig. Anne spends a restless night in her old room, in her old bed. She lies awake all night, listening and thinking. On top of the aching loss of her child, she feels betrayed by everyone. Betrayed by Marco for his part in the kidnapping. Betrayed by her father for his part. Even more despicable if Marco is right about him. And she's sure Marco is right, because her father denied knowing Derek Honig. If her father weren't involved in Cora's disappearance, he would have no reason to deny knowing Honig. She'd had her answer. So when he'd asked her, she'd pretended that she didn't recognize Derek, that she'd never seen him before. She wonders how much her mother knows, or suspects. Anne almost ruined everything last night, at the beginning, but then she got hold of herself, remembered what she had to do. She feels bad for Marco, but not that bad, given what he's done, for the way she didn't speak up last night. But she wants her child back. She is certain she has seen the dead man before, several times, at this very house, years ago. He and her father used to talk out back near the trees, late at night after she'd gone to bed. She would watch them from her window. She never saw Derek Honig with her father sitting around the pool having drinks, or with anyone else present, not even her mother. He would always arrive late, after dark, and then they'd go out back to talk, near the trees. She knew instinctively as a child not to ask her father about it, that what they were doing was secret. What sorts of things have they done together over the years, if they've kidnapped her child? What is her father capable of? She gets up and looks out the bedroom window that faces the grounds behind the house and the woods leading into the ravine. It's been a hot night, but now there's a slight breeze coming in through the screen. It's very early. She can just see the outlines of the world outside the window. She hears a noise from downstairs, a door closing softly. It sounds like the back door in the kitchen. Who would be going out at this early hour? Maybe her mother can't sleep either. Anne thinks about going downstairs to join her, to confront her, and see if her mother can tell her anything. From the window, she sees her father slipping away from the house and across the back lawn. He strides purposefully, as if he knows exactly where he's going. He is carrying a large gym bag. She watches him from behind the curtain, the way she used to as a child, afraid he might turn around and catch her spying, but he doesn't turn around. He heads for the opening in the trees where the path starts. She knows that path well. At home, Marco can't sleep either. He rattles around alone in the house, torturing himself with his thoughts. Anne has left him for good. Cynthia's video has destroyed him in Anne's eyes. She betrayed him last night, not admitting she'd seen her father with Derek Honig, but he doesn't blame her. She did what she had to do, and he understands why. Because she did what she had to do, maybe Cora will be returned to them. Returned to Anne, not to Marco. It occurs to Marco that he may never be able to see Cora again. Anne will divorce him, of course. She will get the best lawyers, and she will get full custody. And if Marco tries to enforce his visiting rights, Richard will threaten to go to the police about his role in the kidnapping. He has forfeited any right to his child. He is alone. He has lost the two people who matter most to him in the world, his wife and his child. Nothing else matters anymore. It hardly seems important now that he is financially ruined or that he is being blackmailed. All he can do now is pace the house and wait for Cora to be found. He wonders, will anyone even let him know? His exclusion from their tight family circle is complete. Maybe he will have to learn about Cora's return from the dead in the newspapers. Anne hesitates for just a moment. There is only one reason she can think of for her father to be heading into the ravine at this hour with no one to see him, carrying a large gym bag. He is going to get Cora. Someone is going to meet with him in the ravine. She's not sure what to do. Should she follow him, or should she stay put and trust him to bring her baby back? But Anne is through trusting her father. She needs to know the truth. Anne hurriedly throws on the clothes she'd worn the day before and makes her way quickly downstairs to the kitchen and out the back door. The cool, dewy air hits her and makes goosebumps come up on her arms. She starts off across the wet grass, following in her father's footsteps. She has no plan. She is operating on instinct. She runs lightly down the wooden stairs that lead into the forested ravine, one hand on the rail, almost flying in the near dark. She once knew the way well, but it's been years since she took this path. Still, memory serves her. It is even darker in here, in the woods. The ground underfoot is soft and damp and swallows up her footsteps. She makes little noise as she moves down the dirt path as quickly as she can after her father. It's spooky in the dark. She can't see him ahead, but she has to assume that he's sticking to the path. Anne's heart is pounding with fear and exertion. She knows everything is coming down to this moment. She believes her father has come out here to regain possession of her child and bring her back. Suddenly, she realizes that if she stumbles into the meeting, she might ruin everything. She must stay hidden. She stands still for a moment, listening, peering into the murky forest. She sees nothing but trees and shadows. She begins to move along the path again, more cautiously, but as quickly as she can, almost blindly, panting heavily with panic and exertion. She comes to a turn in the path, where another set of wooden stairs leads steeply to a residential street above. She looks up. There, ahead, she can see her father. He's alone, coming down the stairs that lead up out of the ravine and into the next street. He has a bundle in his arms. He must see her now. Can he tell it is her in the forest, in the dark? Daddy! She screams. Anne? He calls. What are you doing out here? Why aren't you asleep? Is that Cora? She comes closer, breathing heavily. She's at the bottom of the stairs now. Her father is halfway down, coming toward her. It's beginning to be lighter now. She can see his face. Yes, it's Cora, he cries. I got her back for you. The bundle is not squirming. It hangs like dead weight in his arms. He walks down the stairs toward her. She stares, appalled, at the unmoving bundle in his arms. Then, as fast as she can, Anne runs up the steps to meet him. She stumbles, catches herself with her hands. She holds out her arms. Give her to me, she cries. He hands the bundle over to her. She parts the blanket covering the baby's face, terrified of what she might find. The baby is so still. Anne looks upon the baby's face. It is Cora. She seems dead. Anne has to peer closely at her to tell if she's breathing. She is breathing, barely. The baby's eyes flicker behind her pale lids. Anne lays her hand gently on Cora's chest. She can feel the tiny thump-thump of her heart, can feel her little chest rising and falling. She is alive, but she's not well. Anne sits down on the step and immediately puts Cora to her breast. There is still milk there. With a bit of encouragement, the weakened baby latches on, and then she is suckling hungrily. Anne holds her baby to her breast, a moment she never thought she would have again. Tears run down her face as she looks at her nursing child. She glances up at her father, who is still standing over her. He averts his eyes. He tries to explain.
Someone called again about an hour ago, arranged another meeting, in the road on the other side of the ravine. This time a man showed up. I gave him the money and he handed her to me. Thank God. I was just about to bring her home and wake you up.
He smiles at her.
It's over, Anne. We've got her back. I got her back for you.
Anne looks down at her baby, saying nothing. She does not want to look at her father. She has Cora again. She must call Marco. 36. Marco's stomach is churning as his cab pulls up to Anne's parents' house. He sees all the police patrol cars, the ambulance parked near the front door. He recognizes Detective Rasbach's car as well. The cabbie says,
"Hey man, what's going on?"
Marco doesn't answer him. Anne had called him on his cell just a few minutes ago and said, "I have her. She's okay. You have to come." Cora is alive, and Anne called him. What happens next, he has no idea. Marco hurries up the front steps of the house he'd left just hours before and bursts into the living room. He sees Anne on the sofa, cradling their tiny daughter in her arms. A uniformed police officer is standing behind the sofa, as if protecting her. Anne's father and mother are not in the room. Marco wonders where they are, what has happened. He rushes up to Anne and the baby and engulfs them both in a tearful embrace. Then he pulls back and looks carefully at Cora. She's thin and sickly, but she's breathing and sleeping peacefully, her fingers curled. "Thank God," Marco says, trembling, tears running down his face. "Thank God." He gazes in wonder at his daughter and gently strokes the lackluster curls on her head. He has never been happier than he is right now. He wants to hold on to this moment, to remember it forever. "The medics have checked her over and say she's okay," Anne says, "but we should take her to the hospital and have her thoroughly examined." Anne looks drawn and tired, but, he realizes, also truly happy. "What happened? Where are your parents?" Marco asks at last, uneasily. "They're in the kitchen," she says, but before she can say any more, Detective Rasbach joins them in the living room.
"Congratulations," the detective says.
"Thank you," Marco replies.
As usual, he can't read the detective, can't tell what's going on behind those sharp, discerning eyes.
"I'm so glad your baby has been returned to you alive and well," Rasbach says.
He looks directly at Marco.
"I didn't like to say so before, but the odds were against it."
Marco sits nervously by Anne's side, gazing down at Cora, wondering if this happy moment is about to be snatched away from him, wondering if Rasbach is going to tell him he knows all about it. Marco wants to put that off, preferably forever, but he has to know. The tension is unbearable.
"What happened?" he asks again.
"I couldn't sleep," Anne tells him. "From my bedroom window, I saw Dad going out to the ravine. He was carrying a gym bag. I thought he was going to meet the kidnappers again. I followed him into the ravine, and by the time I caught up with him, he had her. The kidnappers had called again and arranged another exchange. This time a man showed up, with Cora."
She turns to the detective.
"He was gone by the time I caught up with my father."
Marco waits silently. So this is how they're going to play it. He tries to work out the ramifications. Richard is to be the hero. He and Alice have paid, again, to get Cora back. Anne has just told the police this. Marco doesn't know whether she actually believes it or not. Marco has no idea what the detective believes.
"What happens now?"
Marco asks. Rasbach looks at him.
"Now, Marco? We tell the truth."
Marco feels suddenly lightheaded, almost dizzy. He sees Anne look up from the baby to the detective, alert to disaster.
"What?"
Marco says. He can feel the perspiration starting to prickle his skin. Rasbach sits down in the chair across from them, leans forward intently.
"I know what you did, Marco. I know you took your baby from her crib and put her in the back of Derek Honig's car just after 12:30 that night. I know Derek drove her to his cabin in the Catskills, where he was brutally murdered a few days later."
Marco says nothing. He knows this is what Rasbach has believed all along, but what proof does he have? Has Richard told them about the phone? Is that what he's been doing in the kitchen? Has Anne told them about the video? Suddenly Marco can't bear to look at his wife.
"Here's what I think, Marco," Rasbach says, speaking rather slowly, as if he understands that Marco is in so much distress that he may have trouble following. "I think you needed money. I think you set this kidnapping up with Derek Honig to get money from your wife's parents. I don't think your wife knew anything about it."
Marco shakes his head no. He must deny everything.
"After that," Rasbach says, "I'm not clear. Maybe you can help me. Did you kill Derek Honig, Marco?"
Marco starts violently. "No! Why would you think that?" He's very agitated. He wipes his sweaty hands on his pants.
"Derek betrayed you," Rasbach says calmly. "He didn't bring the baby to the exchange as planned. He took the money for himself. You knew where he was with the baby. You knew about the cabin in the woods."
"No!"
Marco shouts. I didn't know where the cabin was. He never told me.
It is perfectly silent in the room, except for the tick of a clock on the mantelpiece. With a sob, Marco buries his face in his hands.
Razbak waits, lets the damning silence fill the room. Then he says, more gently,
Marco, I don't think you meant for it to happen this way. I don't think you killed Derek Honig. I think your father-in-law, Richard Dries, killed Derek Honig.
Marco lifts his head.
If you come clean with us, if you tell us everything you know to help us in our case against your father-in-law, we might be able to talk about a deal.
What kind of a deal? Marco asks. His mind is racing.
If you help us, we might be able to offer you immunity from prosecution on the conspiracy to kidnap charge. I can speak to the prosecutor. I think he'll agree, under the circumstances.
Marco suddenly sees hope where there was none before. His mouth has gone dry. He can't speak. He nods instead. It seems to be good enough.
You'll have to come down to the station, Razbak says, after we wrap up here. He stands up and goes back to the kitchen.
Anne remains in the living room, cradling her sleeping baby, but Marco gets up and follows Razbak into the kitchen. He's surprised his legs work well enough to carry him there.
Richard is sitting in one of the kitchen chairs, stubbornly silent. Their eyes meet. Richard slide away.
A uniformed officer nudges Richard to stand up and puts handcuffs on him.
Alice watches from the background, saying nothing, her face blank.
Richard Adam Dries, Detective Razbak says, you are under arrest for the murder of Derek Honig and conspiracy to kidnap Cora Conti. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say or do can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney.
Marco watches, astonished at his luck. His baby is back, safe. Richard has been found out and will get what he deserves. He, Marco, will not be prosecuted. Cynthia has nothing to hold over him now.
He can feel himself breathe for the first time since this nightmare began. It's over. It's finally over.
Two uniformed officers lead Richard in handcuffs out through the living room and toward the front door, Razbak and Marco and Alice following behind.
Richard says nothing. He won't look at his wife, his daughter, his grandchild, or his son-in-law.
Marco, Anne, and Alice watch him go.
Marco casts a glance at his wife. They have their adored baby back. Anne knows everything now. There are no more secrets between them.
At the police station, they work out the details of Marco's deal. Marco has a new lawyer from a top criminal firm in the city, a firm other than Aubrey West's.
Marco tells Razbak everything. He says, Richard framed me. He set me up. He sent Derek to me. It was all his idea. They knew I needed money.
Anne speaks up.
We thought my father was behind this. I knew he knew Derek Honig. I recognized him. He used to come to the house years ago.
But how did you know?
Razbak answers, I knew he was lying. He said the kidnappers had called him, but we have taps on his phones. We knew they hadn't called him. Then, late last night, your mother called me.
My mother?
Your father has been having an affair.
I know, Anne says. My mother told me this morning.
Marco says, what does that have to do with anything?
Your mother-in-law hired a private detective to find out what he was up to. The detective put a GPS tracking device on Richard's car a few weeks ago. It's still there.
Marco and Anne listen closely to the detective.
We know that Richard drove out to the cabin around the time of the murder.
Marco and Anne exchange glances. Razbak adds, addressing Anne,
your mother recognized Honig, too, as soon as I showed her a photograph of him.
Marco says, Richard had the cell phone, Derek's cell phone, the one we were supposed to use to stay in touch. But Derek never called me, and he never answered his cell. I noticed there were some missed calls, and when I called the number, Richard answered. He said the kidnappers sent him the phone in the mail with a note, but I wondered if he'd killed Derek and taken it. I never believed him about the note. He said he'd destroyed it to protect me, because it implicated me.
Razbak says, Alice never saw the note or the cell phone. Richard said they arrived when she was out.
Why would Richard kill Derek? Marco asks.
We think that Derek was supposed to return the baby when you brought the ransom money, but didn't, and Richard realized he'd been double-crossed. We think Richard tracked him down to the cabin that night and killed him. That's when he saw the opportunity to make a second ransom demand for more money.
Where was Cora after she was taken from the cabin? Who was taking care of her?
Anne asks. We stopped Richard's secretary's daughter in her car leaving the area just after Richard got the baby back earlier this morning. She had the baby. It turns out she's got a bit of a drug problem and needed money.
Anne gasps, horrified, her hand to her face. Exhausted but relieved, Anne and Marco are back home at last with Cora. After going to the police station, Anne and Marco had taken Cora to the hospital, where she was checked out and given a clean bill of health. Now Marco puts together a quick meal for the two of them, while Cora has another greedy feed. The press is no longer clamoring at their doorstep. Their new lawyer has made it clear that Anne and Marco will not speak to them at all, and has threatened legal action if they are harassed. At some point, when things settle down, they will list the house for sale. Finally, they put Cora to bed in her own crib. They have undressed her and given her a bath, studying her as carefully as they had when she was a newborn, to make sure she's all right. And it is a kind of rebirth, getting her back from the dead. Perhaps it's a new beginning for them. Anne tells herself that children are resilient. Cora will be fine. They stand beside the crib, looking down at their baby as she smiles and gurgles up at them. It is such a relief to see her smile. In the first few hours after they got her back, she had just suckled and cried endlessly. But now Cora is beginning to smile again. She lies on her back in the crib, the stenciled lambs and her two parents hovering over her, and playfully kicks out her legs. "I never thought this moment would come," Anne whispers.
"Me either," Marco says, waving Cora's rattle at her. She squeals and grabs it and holds on tight.
They are quiet for a while, watching until their daughter falls asleep.
"Do you think you can ever forgive me?"
Marco asks finally.
Anne thinks, "How can I ever forgive you for how selfish and weak and stupid you were?"
She says, "I don't know, Marco. I have to take it one day at a time." He nods, stung. After a moment, he says, "There were never any other women, Anne. I swear it."
"I know."
37. Anne puts Cora back down in her crib, hoping this is the last feed of the night and that now the baby will sleep through till morning. It's late, very late, but she can still hear Cynthia moving around restlessly in the house next door. It has been a day of shocking revelations. After her father had been taken away from the family home in handcuffs, her mother had pulled Anne aside while Marco held the sleeping baby in his arms in the living room.
"I think you should know," she said, "who your father was seeing."
"Does it matter?" Anne asked. What difference did it make who her father was seeing? She would be younger and attractive, of course. Anne didn't care who she was. What mattered was that her father, actually, she remembers, her stepfather, had kidnapped her baby to get millions of dollars of her mother's money. Now he would go to jail for kidnapping and murder. She still couldn't believe it was all real.
"He was seeing your next-door neighbor," her mother said. "Cynthia Stillwell."
Anne looked back at her mother in disbelief, still capable of being shocked by this news, in spite of everything that had happened.
"He met her at your New Year's Eve party," her mother said. "I remember her flirting with him. I didn't think too much of it at the time, but the private detective found out everything. I have photographs." Her mother's face showed disgust. "Photocopies of hotel receipts."
Anne asked, "Why didn't you tell me?"
"I only found out recently," Alice explained. "Then Cora was taken, and I didn't want to upset you with it.
She added, rather bitterly, "That detective was one of the best investments I ever made." Now Anne wonders what's going through Cynthia's mind. Graham is away. She's alone next door. She must know that Richard has been arrested. It's been on the news. Does Cynthia even care what happens to Richard? The baby is sound asleep in her crib. Marco is asleep in their bed, snoring deeply. It's the first time he's really slept in more than a week. But Anne is wide awake. And so is Cynthia, next door. Anne slips on some sandals and lets herself out the kitchen door. She quietly walks the few steps over to Cynthia's backyard, careful not to let the gate bang shut. She crosses the patio and stands in the dark, her face a couple of inches from the glass, looking through the sliding glass door. There is a light on in the kitchen. She can see Cynthia moving around at the counter near the sink, but realizes Cynthia probably can't see her. Anne watches her for a while in the darkness. Cynthia is making herself some tea. She is wearing a sexy nightgown, pale green. It's very provocative for a night spent at home alone. Cynthia obviously has no idea Anne is there watching her. Anne knocks lightly on the glass. She sees Cynthia jump and turn toward the sound. Anne presses her face up against the glass. She can tell Cynthia isn't sure what she should do, but then Cynthia walks over to the door and opens it a few inches. "What do you want?" Cynthia asks coldly. "Can I come in?" Anne asks. Her voice is neutral, even friendly. Cynthia looks warily at her but doesn't say no and steps back. Anne opens the door wider and comes inside, closing the door carefully behind her. Cynthia returns to the counter and says over her shoulder, "I was just making some tea. Chamomile. Would you like some? It seems neither of us can sleep tonight." "Sure, why not?" Anne says agreeably. She watches Cynthia busy herself making another cup of tea. She seems nervous. "So why are you here?" Cynthia says bluntly, handing Anne the cup. "Thank you," Anne says, settling in her old spot at the kitchen table, as if they were still friends, sitting down for some tea and a chat. She ignores Cynthia's question. She looks around the kitchen, blowing on the hot drink to cool it, as if she has nothing particular on her mind at all. Cynthia remains standing at the counter. She's not going to pretend that they are still friends. Anne studies her over the rim of her cup. Cynthia looks tired, less attractive. For the first time, Anne can see hints of what Cynthia might look like as she ages. "We have Cora back," Anne says blithely. "You probably heard." She cocks her head toward the common wall. She knows that Cynthia must be able to hear her baby crying through it. "How lovely for you," Cynthia says. There is a kitchen island between them, with a wooden knife block full of knives on it. Anne has the same set at home. It was on special at the grocery store not long ago. Anne puts her cup down on the table. "I just wanted to be clear about something." "Clear about what?" Cynthia says. "You won't be blackmailing us with that video." "Oh, and why's that?" Cynthia says, as if she doesn't believe it for a moment, as if she thinks this is all just posturing. "Because the police know what Marco did," Anne says. "I told them about your video." "Really?" Cynthia looks skeptical. She looks as if she thinks Anne is bullshitting her. "And why would you tell them that? Won't Marco go to jail?" "Oh, wait. You want him to go to jail." She gives Anne a superior look. "I can't say I blame you." "Marco's not going to jail," Anne says. "I wouldn't be so sure." "Oh, I'm sure. Marco's not going to jail because my father, your lover, has been arrested for murder and conspiracy to kidnap, as I'm sure you also probably know by now." Anne watches Cynthia's face harden. "Oh, yes, I know all about it, Cynthia. My mother had a private detective watching you two. She has photos, receipts, everything." Anne takes another sip of tea, enjoying herself. "Your secret affair isn't so secret after all." Anne finally has the upper hand, and she likes it. She smiles at Cynthia. "So what?"
Cynthia says finally, but Anne can tell she's unnerved. What you might not know, Anne says, is that Marco's cut a deal. Anne sees something like alarm flit across Cynthia's face, and Anne comes to the reason she's here. She says, ominously, "You were in on this all along. You knew all about it."
"I knew nothing about it," Cynthia says scornfully, "except that your husband stole his own child."
"Oh, I think you knew. I think you were in on this with my father. We all know how much you love money," Anne says with a trace of venom. "Maybe you're the one who's going to go to jail." Cynthia's face changes.
"No, I didn't know what Richard had done, not until I saw it on the news tonight. I wasn't involved. I thought Marco had done it. You can't prove anything against me. I haven't been anywhere near your baby."
"I don't believe you," Anne says.
"I don't care what you believe. It's the truth," Cynthia says.
She looks at Anne with narrowed eyes.
"What happened to you, Anne? You used to be such fun, so interesting, and then you had a baby. Everything about you changed. Do you even realize how dull and dumpy and boring you've become? Poor Marco. I wonder how he stands it."
"Don't try to change the subject. Don't make this about me. You had to know what my father was up to, so don't lie to me." Anne's voice shakes with anger.
"You'll never be able to prove that, because it simply isn't true," Cynthia says. Then she adds, cruelly, "If I'd been involved, do you think I would have let the baby survive? It would probably have been better for Richard just to kill it at the beginning, and a lot less trouble. It would have been a pleasure to stop that brat's endless crying."
Then Cynthia looks scared. She realizes she's gone too far. Anne's chair falls suddenly backward. Cynthia's habitual smugness is replaced by a look of blind terror. Her china teacup shatters on the floor as she lets out a hideous, ear-splitting scream. Marco has been deeply asleep, but in the middle of the night he wakes suddenly. He opens his eyes. It is very dark, but there are red lights flashing, circling around the bedroom walls. Emergency vehicle lights. The bed is empty beside him. Anne must be up again, feeding the baby. He is curious now. He gets up and walks over to the bedroom window, which looks out over the street. He pushes the curtain aside and peers out. It's an ambulance. It is parked directly below him and to the left, in front of Cynthia and Graham's house. His whole body tenses. Now he sees the black and white police cars on the other side of the street, more arriving as he watches. His fingers on the curtain twitch involuntarily. His body is shot through with adrenaline. A stretcher appears from out of the house, carried by two ambulance attendants. There must be someone on the stretcher, but he can't see for sure until the medic moves. There is no urgency about them. The medic shifts position. Marco sees that there is someone on the stretcher, but he can't tell who it is because the face is covered. Whoever is on the stretcher is dead. All the blood rushes from Marco's head. He feels he might pass out. As he watches, a lock of long, jet-black hair escapes and falls down below the stretcher. He looks back at the empty bed.
"Oh, God," he whispers. "Anne, what have you done?"
He runs out of the bedroom, glances quickly in the baby's room. Cora is asleep in her crib. Panicking now, he races down the stairs, stops dead in the darkened living room. He can see the side of his wife's head. She is sitting on the sofa in the dark, completely still. He approaches her, filled with dread. She is slumped on the sofa, staring straight ahead as if in a trance, but as she hears him approach, she turns her head. She is holding a large carving knife in her lap. The red, pulsing light from the emergency vehicles outside circles the living room walls and bathes them in a lurid glow. Marco can see that the knife and her hands are dark, dark with blood. She is covered in it. There are dark splatters on her face and in her hair. He feels sick, like he might throw up. "Anne," he whispers, his voice a broken croak. "Anne, what have you done?" She looks back at him in the dark and says,
"I don't know. I don't remember."
This is Kirsten Potter. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Couple Next Door by Sherry LaPena. This program was directed by Christina Rooney, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2016 by 1742145, Ontario Limited. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.